Stanley Fall, Real 7. Yes, so you're at boarding school now for a school in Brighton for 18 months. Where was that?
That was in Upper Drive here. And I was taken in, and the only person I could converse with was the headmaster, because he was speaking German. So there I was at 1945, I was 16, and I was taken to a school where I couldn't communicate with anybody, and so the only person I was communicating with the headmaster, and he said, well, what you've got to do is you've got to basically listen to the radio. Listen to the words, and then he gave me various books, and you've got to try and acquaint yourself with the English language, which I did. So for the next 3 months, I was basically locked in, trying to dismiss all my other languages which I knew of, couldn't communicate with anybody except him, listening to the radio, and learning the language. Well, I found that I could understand English a lot quicker than I could speak it. I could understand the words, but it wouldn't come out. It's taken me about the first term. It was a January term, I remember, a winter term, when I was isolated. I was looking at people, listening to them, young boys and girls from a mixed school, and I could understand what they're saying, but I couldn't communicate, I couldn't answer back. And that came after a while. After the first term, I was being able to communicate or make myself understood in broken English. And after the second term, I remember, I got 98% in Latin. Because Latin is similar to Polish. And I started from scratch, and of course my education was such that it was speaking strictly on languages. Latin was simple to me. English was the main language I had to learn. And after two terms, my marks were about 90% for English. Written. My communication was still difficult, but because I was reading a lot and I was listening a lot, I was trying, and all of a sudden, like overnight, I started being able to communicate with my teachers, and so then, because by which time, once I could speak a bit, my uncle said, right, now. What you now need to do is get some business experience. So I was sent to Clark's College in Brighton, which was in those days a secretarial school for mainly girls. But they had an English course as well. So I continued with that, and also a business course. And I remember that my favorite thing used to be that the English master used to read the Daily Telegraph editorial page. And that was the good English part. And we said to sit down and write it. He used to speak very slowly. And we used to write it to make sure that our writing is correct and it's good English. In other words, it's grammatically correct. And this is my and I used to get good marks for this. So the English was priority. The business side was another side, which I took to. And by the time I was sort of 18, I said to my uncle, I need to earn a living. So he said, now you're now ready, but you're not ready to start working here. You've got to go and find out what a foreman does and what it means to have good timekeeping and to work for a firm. So he, through his connections, I got a job as a draftsman, that's dealing with ordering metal stuff for CVA, which was a very big firm in those days. They're no longer here, an engineering firm. And I was on the drafting department, dealing with ordering goods. And I liked it very much. And at that time, I was earning £1 a week. And my uncle used to subsidize my brother, because I lived with him at the time. And I liked it very much, but they asked me to join the union. And I said to my uncle, only costs 3 shillings a week to join the union, and I'd be able to get an extra pound a week if I joined the union. He said, now that you understand the workings, it's time to come into the firm. And he took me away from there, and he gave me what we call a very fast training, because we had sort of various departments within the works. We employed about 60 odd people, and metal processing was one part, the waste department of, so in those days, a shortage after the war, rabbit skins, rags which were for replacement purposes, bottles, metals which were collected by the refuse collection. That was separated and sold to us, and we used to have to sort it. We had a partner sorting. So between the various waste departments, because now people think that reusable materials are only happened recently. It's been going on from time immemorial as far as my firm is concerned. We're dealing with the recycling materials. That was my first training, and it's taken me about 18 months to go through the training in various departments before I was allowed to get into the head office. And once I received, I was taken to the head office, which was in Brighton. During that time, unfortunately, my uncles became very ill. One had a heart attack, and the other one had cancer, and they both died. And of course, my brother and I were trained, and we were, but we decided to start on our own, or rather he did, my brother did. And we moved away to Maidstone, and we started a business on ourselves, and we done very, very well. But once my uncle died in 1951. Between 51, I was asked to come back because my cousins or his sons were too young to run the business, they were untrained. And then I came back and ran the business, expanded the business with a view to while my brother continued in Maidstone. Well, my brother's done extremely well on his own without me. And he eventually employs some 300 people, and he became a public company in order to protect the family interests, of which he was a chairman. And so he did extremely well. And he was very well liked until he became very ill, and that all went. Unfortunately, was sold off. But I stayed in Brighton with my original firm, and he then, and I met my wife, which became my wife, in 1954. We had three children, three boys, and all done very well academically, and we are still here. I'm still here to tell the tale.
Yes, I was wondering about your social life, you know, because putting myself in your position, you know, with very little language and going to a school. Did you feel isolated at that time? Was it a difficult time for you, Stanley?
It was very difficult because I couldn't communicate. I couldn't make myself understood. And I couldn't understand what the other people are saying or doing. So it was a difficult time, but I am a survivor, and I've had difficulties before. My job was to get over those difficulties. In order to combat, I remember that in the boarding school, you've got to have lights out at a certain time. And my brother gave me a torch, and I was reading well into the night, because once I was I was told that I've got to learn the language. The only way I can do so is by listening, reading, and understanding what it's all about in order to communicate. So I worked very hard at that time, and this is the time when I felt isolated, but I said, it's up to me. I was the chap in charge of myself, and that's what I like to do. And I conquered it.
How did the other children relate to you? You know, were they, did you ever have any problems?
Well, after the first, no, I had problems from a point of view that being what the headmaster thought sensible, I was made a prefect, which meant that I was in charge of a section. And then I was made the deputy head boy. Then I was made the head boy. Now, when you're an authority, you don't make many friends. But I remember that I went to my friend's wedding, and their daughter, and she was telling me, in those days, her mother had a delicatessen shop. Because she was given, we said pack boxes, and she was given food. Which the ordinary boys never used to go to in a boarding school. And of course, during the tap area, there was a day when you, a certain time, half an hour, when they allowed to have their boxes and everybody else. I was in charge of that to make sure the keys were opened up and all that. But of course, she was giving various food to the various people. Well, it was not permitted. Because you only have to, the tap was for you. If you try and trade it with other people, that was, and of course, she would be punished. The only punishment I was allowed to give is lines. You know, I will not do this, and I will not do 100 lines, or 20 lines, 50 lines, 100 lines. Well, I've forgotten all about this. When my wife and I were invited to her daughter's wedding, about 30 years later, in her speech, she mentioned it. She said, talking about her, and he asked me, he's the one who should give me lines. justifiably, she realized she'd done the wrong thing, and I did the right thing, but she made out of 300 people, in her speech, she mentioned it. This is what I, so anybody in authority did not like. Because, you know, he's got to exert his authority. To answer your question, but I used to get by. I was just.
How important was it, do you think, looking back, how important was it that you had relatives here, and particularly your brother, when you think of the other boys, you know, that...
I think it was a marvellous, as far as I was concerned, it was a very stable relationship because, you see, I never looked for anybody else. Now, all the other 350 boys who I came over, because we meet each other at least twice a year on their reunion, have got each other. Now they're married, they've got their own families. But at that time, they only had each other to talk to and be with. And they used to live in hostels. And of course, they used to keep they used to go out together like brothers. And this is why they referred to me as an outsider, because I had a brother. And none of them had any relations or relatives, mother, father, brother, except me. And this is why I always stood out. But I and my brother got on extremely well because he was a very caring person. And I respected him because he was my brother and the only one I had. So I couldn't compare them. And we kept we're always very, very close. He was more or less like my mentor. But my uncle, of course, treated me like a son. More than, well, equal to his own sons. He had two children. And when he died, he left half his estate to me. So that you can see that he has some... didn't tell me that he's going to, but only found out afterwards. In other words, he must have a certain care and respect for me to have done that. Because he always told me that he thinks that I am different by virtue of I'm logical. That's his opinion of me. I wouldn't know that.
But you are, do you consider yourself one of the boys? You know, you do go to the meetings and...
Yes. I like to keep in touch, and when we go abroad, I always find some of them living in America, in Israel, we meet them, and we have, with our wives and our families, and because I still feel that we have got a bond. Because we went through such a horror that, which are very few people in the world who've gone through that, we're still together. This is where our bond is very, very close. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it was interesting when you were saying earlier how it's impossible to really understand the full reality of what you went through without actually being there. You really feel that.
Even now, it is not possible for the abnormality of the situations in the extermination camps. The brutality was so horrific that it is not possible, doesn't matter which nationality, any human being to comprehend, to see people shot for no reason, to see their brains splatter out at a young age, and which you think is normal. I have seen people who are begging for food being brutally hurt, and if they kept on crying, an officer used to come out and shoot them. And of course, it is something which is not normal to an extent. It is very difficult to explain, but when you see it happening, I felt that this is what goes on, because it is normal. Somebody in authority has got a gun, he can do that. Because unless you are educated, know this is abnormal, that there should be law and order by a judge and jury, not a person of sadistic nature to take out a gun or a baton and kill somebody, or brutally hurt women, children, elderly people, old people. Doesn't matter, there's no discrimination. This is something which is so horrific that I feel that a normal person couldn't understand it. They could not live through it, because it's not possible to think. To me now, looking back, I don't know how people could behave like that. What drove them to it? To be so sadistic and to have such pleasure doing it. And that is only either that the element of those people were criminal, sadistic, or sick. That is the only answer I could give. And many a time I think to myself, why was it possible to, how, wonderful it was for a small minority of the German people to organize and let the majority follow them. This is what I can't, to this day, understand. The only way I feel that it was to, between the First and the Second War, the Germans went through a horrific economic crisis where the currency was valueless, and they've gone through such horrific times that when a leader came out in the way of Hitler, and whatever he said, they believed him, because by virtue of getting the armaments organized, he got the masses in work, and they were following a leader because they're very regimented, the Germans. They say, if they find somebody which they like, they say, he's the man to follow, they would, for whatever reason, they would follow him. And this is the only way I can think of that they went through a tremendous period during Stump, as it were, early between the wars, when their money was worth nothing, and unemployment. And because of this, they've chosen a leader which they hoped will get them out of trouble, and he did right up to 1941 do so. What he did to be, between 1933 and 1941, he was on a winning spree. Whatever he did, he promised, he did. And of course, they followed him. But of course, then it turned round, and of course, he's taken the blame. But of course, to this day, I can't see how the Poles, as it were helping without any reward. They were doing it because they wanted to. That, to me, is unforgivable.
The fact that you went through all this, you know, first of all, the anti-Semitism, which you've explained so well, particularly from the Poles, the Polish population, and how this was made manifest with all the brutality and the, you know, tribulations and sufferings you had to go through. And this was because you were Jewish. Did it have any effect on you and your sense of Jewish identity?
Well, I was born Jewish. We came from not an Orthodox family, but I knew what the Jewish festivals were and Jewish history up to the age of 8 or 9. I could not understand the treatment of the Germans against Jews. And I looked many a time when the brutality in Warsaw, before the ghetto was closed, of German, which now I understand were virtually a sadistic lot, were beating old Jewish rabbis, Jewish students. And I looked up to heaven and I said, now, where is God? What happened? I mean, these are pious, very Orthodox, learned Jewish rabbis who are studying the Talmud and the Torah day and night, sort of thing, as a continuous job. And I looked upon them as sages. And there the young boys beating them, pulling their beards to an extent, which I believe is brutal. And I thought, now, where is God? And this was the only time, or during that time, I was very, I said earlier on that I was being looked over by third parties, be it my parents, or be it their parents, or, but at that time, I looked up to heaven and I said, why aren't these sadists struck down? And it didn't happen. So there was a difficult time. That's the answer to your question.
Your sense of Jewishness, though, and you had to wear a yellow star. How did that affect you? You know, did you feel, were you ever made to feel ashamed of being Jewish or otherwise?
No, we always, I personally remember that I was proud to be Jewish because I was born as such and I was educated in a Jewish school, a Jewish Polish school, and I couldn't understand certain people who wanted to either change or to go over the wall, in other words, to become Huluk Polish, as it were, and said, no, we want to save our life by being with the Poles. I couldn't understand that. I think if you're Jewish, you're Jewish. If you're black, you're black, or whatever. You can't change sides to suit you. But, of course, at that time, being in sort of in the melting pot with the Jews, we were all in the same pot. There was no way out. There wasn't a basis of saying, look, we had an option not to be Jewish. We were Jews. But my fortunate part was that I was taken as a prisoner of war, not as a Jew. The Jewish extermination camps and various other camps outside Majdanek, which was a transit camp, were extermination only. But we were very fortunate, we were taken to as prisoners of war because of the uprising in 1933.
When the State of Israel was founded in, what was it, 1948?
Eight.
Yeah. Was that important to you? Is Israel important?
It was, because the greater majority of us boys put their names down to go to Palestine, because this is their no home in Poland, and they said the only place they'll go to Palestine, and of course they weren't permitted to go. So when the State of Israel was formed in 1948, I said, now at least we've got an authority answerable for Jews all over the world, and that was a very good feeling as far our club, the 45 group club, were concerned, because there's an answer. If anything happens like this to Jews anywhere else, there's an army, there's a state to take our part. Because up to then, there's nobody to take our part officially, either through the United Nations or even directly or indirectly to intervene with countries. So this was a very happy time for us, the boys, as it were. And of course, even to this day, I support the State of Israel because I feel that without them, it would be more trouble than there is. At least we've got a state which protects and gives a civilized, international recognized situation on the international forum as far as the world Jews are concerned. So this is a very good thing.
Well, Mr. Fogg, thank you very much indeed for telling me about your Holocaust experiences. Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.